I'm very happy to welcome Ed McMahon back to the show this afternoon. He has made appearances on this show several times over the years, and of course, St. Louis, for a while, was his second home because of his association with Anheuser-Busch here in town. He has a new book out called When Television Was Young, Live, Spontaneous, and in Living Black and White. Hi, Ed. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Good. It's nice to be back on your show again.
Always a pleasure talking to you. And I'm actually very jealous of this guy, David Fisher, who wrote the book with you, because I know that in order to put together a book like this, it meant he sat in a room with you and heard lots of great old stories from your career, which I've had the opportunity to do a couple of times in person with you. But it's always such a pleasure talking about those days with you. So I'm looking forward to spending a few minutes with you here this afternoon.
I love it too, Paul. Thank you.
Now, before we get to that, I do have to ask you about the writer's strike. The Writers Guild of America.
Yes. As I understand, they left last night with no extension, no agreement. They've got apparently an okay to strike, and it looks like that's what's going to happen. According to the papers this morning, looks like there's no meeting of the minds, so that we will be seeing a lot of our shows disappearing.
Yeah, and that's going to have a particular impact on late-night shows. And I wanted to ask about your experience with this, because in 1988 was the last time these guys went on strike, and it lasted something like 5 months, and you and Johnny were doing The Tonight Show at the time.
Right.
And how did you handle that?
Well, Johnny did the writing. He you know, had been a writer on the Red Skelton Show, so he just did the jokes himself. You know, he came in and did, you know, it was not as big a monologue as it was before, but he came in and wrote a monologue every night.
And did it mean that you couldn't do desk pieces? There wouldn't be Carnac or Aunt Blabby?
No, we could do that. He would write those things as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
Were there times where he would come in and say, come in here, help me work on this?
No, he never asked for my advice. He did it all himself.
Wow. And kept doing it for 5 months, or was there a time where he just said, you know what, we're going to take a couple weeks off?
Because I recall he did it for the 5 months.
Wow. Wow. Now, the book, When Television Was Young, takes us back to your earliest days in television, and literally the earliest day of television, when you were at FDR's first broadcast. Is that right?
Yeah, I was at the World's Fair. I was one of the first few thousand that got into the World's Fair. And he broadcast on television for the first time. Quite a historic moment, and I was there.
And did you have any concept of what was going on around you?
Well, we were aware of it. You know, we had been hearing about pictures through the air. That was the phrase, pictures through the air. And, of course, everybody thought it was impossible. But the people that were putting it together, the engineering departments, they knew it could happen, and they made it happen.
And did you say at the time, I want to do this?
Oh, I had been in radio, so I knew that's what I wanted to do. And, you know, I had my chance because I'd been practicing since I was a little kid, holding a flashlight like it was a microphone,
mm-hmm.
and reading Time magazine aloud. And as far as I was concerned, I was a broadcaster.
I'm sure my mom has a story about me doing something like that when I was a kid.
Probably, yeah.
Those of us who are lifelong broadcasters did start out in the bedroom,
yeah.
or the living room.
A lot of people have told me the same kind of story, that they wanted to be a broadcaster, and that's what they did. They held a broom handle like it was a microphone or something and found a script or something to use as a script, a magazine. Like I use Time magazine. That seemed to be appropriate for me. But somebody did, but a lot of people have mentioned that to me, a lot of broadcasters.
How long after that FDR day of television did you step in front of a live television camera for the first time?
Well, I went to school after the war. I went to school at Catholic University of America in Washington, and I was in a play, and the play was broadcast from the basement of a hotel on the coaxial cable all the way up to New York, and that was quite a historic moment. That was the first time the coaxial cable had ever been used, and I was in the play. So that was my first adventure, but the most significant was on 1949, September 12th, a Monday, I began as host of a three-hour daily live variety show, and that was the first show on television in the daytime in the country. Up until that time, the television day started with Howdy Doody at 5:30. Remember Howdy Doody?
I do.
Howdy Doody time. It's Howdy Doody time.
Yep. And so you were doing a daytime show. Well, that was in Philadelphia by then?
Yes.
And eventually worked your way up to where you were doing more than just that. Weren't you at one point doing daytime and late night TV at the same station?
I had 13 shows on television.
13 shows, Ed?
Unbelievable.
And what was the content? Who was coming up with it?
I had a cooking show with another woman. I had a morning breakfast show. I had an interview show. I had a variety show. I hosted the million-dollar movie. I even had a quiz show. We had when Frozen Foods came out, that was a big deal, you know, to get them as a sponsor. And I stood in front of one of those freezers like you'd see in a grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And the name of the show was Cold Cash. And where do you think we kept the money?
Right in the freezer.
Right in the freezer, right.
I always got the sense that you liked doing commercials because of your days starting out hawking the slicers on the boardwalk in Atlantic City. It seemed like you realized the importance of sponsors to the broadcast medium and wanted to not only deliver for them but have fun with the message. Is that true?
That's true. And you know what else was good for me, Paul? You know, the fact that you had to use your hands. You know, a lot of guys who had great voices and were great radio personalities couldn't make that jump over to television because they had to demonstrate the product. But since I'd been a pitchman with the slicer-dicer machines, I knew how to use my hands as I talked, so it made it a lot easier for me, and I was much more effective than I would have otherwise been. But that was a big key to my success in the early days.
It's News Talk 1120 KMOX. Paul Harris talking with Ed McMahon. His new book is called When Television Was Young: Live, Spontaneous, and in Living Black and White. As always, we have a link to it on KMOX.com. If you use that link to buy the book, a portion of the proceeds will go to help out St. Louis Children's Hospital. Now, Ed, when we talk about your early days in TV, I'm wondering at what point you started getting women to notice you. Because I've talked to several people in the music business and in the broadcasting business, and for many of them, that's the reason they got into the business.
Really?
Was that the case for you at all?
No, that was not the case with me, because I had been married when I was in the Marine Corps. I was married and already had a child, so that wasn't my story. You know, the women were there, but they weren't having anything to do with me.
No? They weren't coming up to you and saying, oh, you're that Ed McMahon I see on TV every day.
Well, they might do that, but that was the end of it. That was the extent of it, Paul. That was the whole thing right there.
And when you were doing all of these shows in Philadelphia and later in other places, in the earliest days of TV, I guess you literally were making up the rules because no one had been there before you, and you kind of had to create the envelope that you were going to push, right?
That's exactly right.
Exactly how would you know what you could and couldn't do?
Well, there were restrictions like there were in radio, and I was of the old school. I never used any language that I wouldn't use on the radio. I used only special language. I hate today when I hear those blips. You know, all these important people using bad language, you know, role models, supposedly, sports figures. It's terrible for the kids to hear that. Because you see the words mouthed by the person, you know what the words are they're saying, and the bleep just kind of obliterates the sound. But, you know, those role models are saying these words, and kids think that's perfectly acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't like that. I didn't like to use any bad language. I never have. I was in the Marine Corps actively for 6 years and never used bad language.
You may have set a record there. You realize that?
I think so.
And by the way, when you were doing it, there was no such thing as delay. So when we talk about live TV, I mean, here we are having a conversation on KMOX, and we're on broadcast delay. There was no such thing. You said it. People heard it instantly in those days.
That's it. Exactly right.
Now, we know that you've talked in the past about your alcohol consumption and some problems from it. But in the days of live TV, could you go on the air with a buzz?
Well, you could. You know, it was wrong to do it, but you could do it, certainly.
Did you?
On one occasion, I had a night when I was a little stretched out.
Yeah?
One bad night.
Is that because you had been out at dinner or something and then ended up going back?
Lunch, and I'd settled two lawsuits at lunch.
Oh.
And I was celebrating a little bit. A little early. Usually I didn't drink before the show. I kept my drinking after the show.
Gotcha. In the book, When Television Was Young, Ed talks to lots of other pioneers of the earliest days of television, including his old buddy Dick Clark, who, of course, we know from the Bloopers, Bleeps, and Blunders shows. How did you guys first meet? Do you remember?
Yeah. When I came back from the Korean War, I had asked the apartment owner, a fellow owned 1,200 apartments. I had an apartment in his complex before I left. So when I left, he and I were good friends, and I said, please save an apartment for me. So when I got back in the States from the Korean War, I made two phone calls. The first was to my wife to tell her I was home safe. I was in the country and I was alive. And the second call was to Dan Kelly to tell him I was here and I needed my apartment. He said, don't worry, I got you a great apartment. So I move into my apartment. Who's my next door neighbor but Dick Clark?
Hmm.
So we became instant friends. My daughter used to babysit his kids. So we would see each other socially, and we did become good pals.
Was Dick a radio disc jockey at the time, or had he already broken into TV?
He had moved over to American Bandstand. When I left for the Korean War, he was a disc jockey, and I knew of him, but we were not pals. But when I came back, he had American Bandstand.
And that was,
hot.
Yeah, that was very hot, first in Philadelphia and then nationally, and of course launched everything that became the Dick Clark empire. And as you talked to him for the book about these adventures in early TV, what kind of stories did he share with you?
Well, you know, his story was the early day of finding out that dancing could be something important on television. You know, they had these young kids, and they brought them in, they let them dance. They were doing it more as a filler. They didn't realize that that would become the thing,
mm-hmm.
that the dance would be the important thing. The kids all over America were watching these kids dance, and they became stars in their own right. Everybody was emulating them.
Not to mention that he got cast members pretty cheap.
That's right. That was a hell of a deal.
His new book, When Television Was Young, Live, Spontaneous, and in Living Black and White, you not only get some of Ed's memories, but also some other TV legends that he spoke to, including Dick Clark and Andy Griffith, Art Linkletter, Gale Storm, Barbara Billingsley, Walter Cronkite, Jerry Mathers, Soupy Sales, Ron Howard, Merv Griffin. Of any of those people, Ed, would you have traded places with any of them, wanting their career instead of yours?
Well, I always admired Merv Griffin. I thought he did a great job. He was a good talk show host. He was the most creative guy in television, coming up with long-lasting success stories in television. It's a tough business to be in the business that he was in, you know, to come up with these great game shows, Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy still running. Now he's got this crosswords show that's apparently a big success. So he was very creative, and I kind of admired that.
Did you know Merv in the days when you and Johnny were competing with him in late night?
Oh, sure. We were friends, yeah.
And for a while, wasn't Johnny's brother directing Merv's show?
He was directing Wheel of Fortune, yes.
How was that? I mean, were you guys just so close that everybody...
Well, they were friends. You know, Johnny and Merv were friends. They would see each other for dinner all the time. So they were good friends. But Dick got that job on his own, you know, just as a good director.
Mm-hmm. Let me just touch on some of the other people that you talked to in here. Andy Griffith, of course, TV icon, one of the great family sitcoms of all time, is The Andy Griffith Show. Was that his first endeavor into television?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And pretty successful one at that.
Indeed.
Yeah. And Ron Howard, of course, started out with him and then went on to do so many other things.
Yeah.
You know, the interesting thing to me about a guy like Ron Howard is being able to survive the child years in TV.
You, of course, be successful afterward. That's very rare.
Yeah. Did he talk at all about how he was able to do that?
No, I think it's just that, you know, he wanted to be in this business so badly that he didn't think of age or didn't think of, you know, being a child star. He just wanted to be in the business and do what he had to do. And I think that shows in his work.
I agree with you. And Walter Cronkite, of course, the TV news legend who has been there covering so many different events. When you talk to Walter, are there stories that you want to hear from him about what he's done?
You do, you know, because you look at him like an established figure. You know, he's not just, you know, a guy on television. He's like a monument. He's Walter Cronkite. And, you know, you respect everything he has done, and you respect all the things that he has, you know, witnessed over the years that he has reported on. So he is like, you know, probably the most, you know, revered man in our business.
What about your buddy Jerry Lewis? I mean, you've done the telethon with him for, is it a half a century? Have you done 50 with him?
40 years. 40 years together.
40 years.
I just did my last telethon with him on September, and that counted for 40 years. I've done the telethon, never missed a telethon. And we've raised in those years $2 billion, with a B, $2 billion. And all that money goes to research and for, you know, braces and wheelchairs and things like that to help the people that have this terrible, one of those terrible diseases.
It's a spectacular effort that the MDA people put together year in, year out. When you say it was your last one, do you mean it's the last one you'll ever do?
Oh, no. That was the last one I happened to do. No, I'll be doing this for as long as they want me.
Have you talked to Jerry about the early days? Is he in the book?
Oh, yeah, he's in the book, and he tells a great story that goes way back to the early days of a secret broadcast that was done in color from NBC in a secret studio that was closely guarded and kept under wraps. He did a broadcast with Bill Joe Bojangles Robinson, the great dancer, and it was broadcast down to Princeton University, and the guy seeing it was Albert Einstein.
What?
Yes, and when they finished, they all got in the car, and they went down to Princeton to see his reaction. Now, wouldn't you like to have been a fly on the wall on that meeting? Jerry Lewis meeting Albert Einstein, nutty professor, and the real professor.
You know, that actually sounds like it's a Jerry Lewis movie.
Yeah, doesn't it?
It does.
But that really happened.
So Einstein and whoever was with him in the room at Princeton, they were the
They were there, and Jerry went down to see what he thought about color television.
But they were the only recipients of this broadcast.
That's right, yeah.
And of course, there's no recording of that anywhere.
No, unfortunately. But it was so secret they had to do it that way.
He and Dean did lots of live TV. They had their own show. They had the Colgate Comedy Hour. Did he make executives at the networks nervous?
Oh, yeah, because you never knew what he was going to do. You know, he was a incredibly flamboyant about his performance and, you know, it was kind of no-holds-barred kind of nightclub performance. So they were always concerned about that.
I would think that they would be, you know, when you have somebody who could do anything at any moment.
Yeah.
And then that leads to the next question, which is, was Dean ever on edge about that when they were together?
I don't think so. Not that I was aware of. You know, I didn't know them at that time.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that that ever happened.
I guess there had to be trust there, right?
Yeah, there was.
It's kind of like you and Johnny had to have.
That's right.
You know, he knew that if he started in on you, that you would roll with the punches. And,
that's right.
And you also knew it was going to be your role to feed him that same way.
Yeah, that's right. And that was great. You know, the people believed that we were pals, which we were, off the screen as well. And I think that helped us a lot. People like to see that.
You know, I had Bob Newhart on the show last week, you know, another TV legend. And I didn't get a chance to ask him about this. And I can't remember if you and I have talked about it. But I've heard a story about a night that Newhart was on the show and had gone down the couch, maybe a couple of positions. And he's sitting there next to you. And maybe it was when the show was 90 minutes long. And now Johnny's gotten to the dreaded author spot. Do you know this story?
Oh, sure. I was involved in it.
Okay. Tell the story for my audience, because I don't know the details the way you do.
The guy was on, Dennis was on, who written a book called Teeth, Teeth, Teeth. Terrible title for a book. Anyway, it was one of those things where it was the end of the show. You know, it was an hour and 45 minutes. And we got down to the point where Johnny was just dying to get finished with everything, get out of there, you know. Anyway, Newhart and I kept moving the clock back. Now, all the clocks were set at the time of day when the show would be on. So it was like coming up to 1 o'clock. So every time Johnny would ask a question, get an answer, look at the clock, it was always 8 minutes to 1. And he was dying. He was just going crazy. And he luckily, he didn't kill us that night.
So who was the person who started this? Was it you or Newhart?
I think the both of us together, we just saw the clock and we kind of looked at each other and knew what to do and did it.
And did you keep a straight face through the whole thing?
Oh, yes, yeah.
So did Johnny, at some point, the show had to come to an end.
Finally, he realized it. You know, about the third or fourth time he looked, he realized it. And he looked at us and he knew what we were doing and he wanted to kill us.
Did you crack up? I'm sure.
Yeah, we did.
The book is called When Television Was Young, Live, Spontaneous, and in Living Black and White. Do you mind taking a couple of phone calls, Ed?
Not at all. Go ahead.
All right, let's do that. 314-436-7900, toll-free, 800-925-1120. If you want to get in here with TV legend Ed McMahon. Again, if you buy the book via KMOX.com, we've got a link in our online bookstore right there. A portion of the proceeds will go to help out St. Louis Children's Hospital. Bill, you're on KMOX. Say hi to Ed.
Good afternoon, Ed. It's so good to hear that you're well and in good spirits and in good health.
Thank you, Bill. I am, and it's very nice of you to mention that. Thank you.
I have sort of two questions. One is that I'm retired Air Force, and as you know, we tend to be a bit proud, not quite as high on the ladder as you Marine folks, but still in all, we're a pretty proud group. Now, with that in mind, it was disconcerting to me to see all of the insinuations and the insults that Johnny gave you, and how well you took it. And I guess I would like you to respond in some way about that. And the other thing is when you mentioned that you and Jerry raised $2 billion, that all of it went to the research, I think, though, it isn't a goodly portion of that went to pay Jerry's expenses?
The first question is the about the Marine Corps. I took that in stride because he was an ensign in the Navy, and of course I came out as a colonel in the Marine Corps, so I, you know, hugely outranked him.
Correct.
That kind of, you know, got him a little steamed, so we kidded about that, friendly, you know, in a nice way.
But you also knew it was part of the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Now, as far as Jerry Lewis is concerned, neither one of us make any money out of that. Naturally, our expenses when we travel, like I'm a member of the board, when I go to board meetings or travel for MDA, they pay my expenses, but neither one of us receive any money for doing that charity.
All right, there you go, Bill. Thank you for calling. Ray, you're on KMOX. Say hi to Ed McMahon.
Hi, Ed. What an
hi,
honor.
Ray.
What an honor. Listen, I got the funniest thing I ever saw, the funniest look on Johnny was, and I can't remember if you were there, Ed, or but Johnny was talking to Doc Severinsen, and so Doc was saying, oh, I got to be off for a couple of days. I'm going to do this. He's going to play somewhere. And Johnny goes, well, what do you mean you got to take off? You can't do that. And either you or Doc said...
It was me.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
What did you say?
You invented it. Yeah, you invented it.
I said, I'm taking a day off. After all, you invented it.
Yeah. That was perfect. That was the funniest thing I ever saw. Thanks, Ed.
All right, Ray. Thanks for calling. Ray. Here's another Bill on KMOX. Hi, Bill. Say hi to Ed McMahon.
How are you, Ed? Great. Good to hear it from you. Ed, I think the funniest thing I've ever seen, it always stands in my mind, is the night Dean Martin, Bob Hope, and George Gobel were on.
Oh, that was a great night.
That was so funny with Martin flipping those ashes and Gobel's drink all the time.
Yeah, that's right.
Was that the night that Gobel came out and said, do you ever feel like you're a pair of brown shoes and the rest of the world's a tuxedo?
That's right, exactly right.
Something like
you
that.
A good memory. That was one of the greatest nights ever on The Tonight Show.
Yeah, I would agree. The book is called When Television Was Young, Live, Spontaneous, and in Living Black and White. It is always a pleasure having you back on the show, Ed. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Paul. I appreciate the help on the book. You're always very good. I should say hello to my friend Jerry Clinton.
Yep.
I shouldn't leave without saying that. And thanks again for helping me.
Well, Jerry was the guy who introduced me to you, so I thank him for that as well. It's always a pleasure. Ed McMahon here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. And a reminder, if you buy the book through KMOX.com, a portion of the proceeds will go to St. Louis Children's Hospital.